You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Just ahead, we look at the work of the digital archive site of political races. Ballotpedia is here and their effort to document American elections without bias. But first, Wisconsin Public Radio was planning to air profiles this week on four candidates in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate. Then, suddenly, three of them dropped out, throwing their support behind Democrat Mandela Barnes in the process. Bridget Bowden has a story on how the race changed overnight.
University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Professor Emeritus Mordecai Lee has been keeping up with elections in Wisconsin since he was a student in the 1960s.
So I've got sort of a good half century worth of memories of how things have been going.
And Lee was surprised when three Democratic candidates who had been running for U.S. Senate for more than a year all dropped out of the race last week.
This has been an astonishing development.
Outagamie County Executive Tom Nelson was the first to announce his exit from the race last week. On Monday morning, he said he was dropping out for financial reasons.
We ran out of money, so it was a question of, do we limp across the finish line and not win, or do we face facts?
Nelson believes that he started a domino effect with the other candidates, especially Milwaukee Bucks executive Alex Lazary, who dropped out just 2 days later. Money wasn't an issue for Lazary, the son of a billionaire who had poured more than $12 million of his own wealth into his campaign. Lazary said internal polling was showing that he was just not going to beat Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes.
This wasn't something where I thought we lost, right? I think Mandela won. And we'll see on August 10th, the final results. But like, I think what prevented us from ever getting, over the hump was the broad coalition of support that the lieutenant governor has.
State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski was the only woman on the ballot. The day Lazary dropped out, she said she had no plans to end her own campaign. But by the end of the week, she had decided to call it quits.
I mean, for me, it was something that I reflected on within literally the last 24 hours. And I know that we're better when we all come together, and that's why, for me, it was pretty immediate.
All three of the candidates endorsed Barnes. And although there are a few other candidates still running, Barnes is all but certain to be the one to face Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson in November's general election. UW-Milwaukee's Lee says it's not hard for the three to appear united in their support for Barnes, because for the most part, they had kept the campaign positive. Nelson had taken some shots at the other candidates, but the race wasn't defined by attack ads.
The fact that they decided not to do it was almost unnatural in terms of just the reality of politics. But the fact that they decided they didn't want to go negative is an indication of maybe sort of things are shifting, at least within the culture of the Democratic Party.
It's a stark contrast to the Republican primary for governor, Lee says, where former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish has attacked businessman Tim Michaels, and Michaels has responded in kind.
I'm just astonished by how vicious they are and how powerfully advocative they are and just dredging up just about anything they can think of.
Lee says candidates in Wisconsin usually stay in the race through Election Day, even if they know they're going to lose. Losing hasn't always been a bad thing, he says. Famed Wisconsin Democrat William Proxmire lost three elections for governor in the 1950s. He even talked about losing in stump speeches. Eventually, he became Wisconsin's longest-serving U.S. senator. But Lee says that was a different time. Beyond just helping Barnes, these candidates likely thought ending their campaigns could end up helping them.
To avoid being tagged with the moniker of a loser, so-and-so is a loser, I think they sort of decided to drop out early, not spend any more money, and sort of stay alive to fight another day.
Lee says that could keep their options open if they run another political campaign in the future, whatever it might be. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And Wisconsin Public Radio will have a story about Democratic Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes tomorrow. You can read our stories on the Republican candidates for governor at WPR.org. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. So ahead of Tuesday's primary and with an eye on the November midterms 14 weeks away, it's timely to look at the work of the Wisconsin-based nonprofit and nonpartisan online encyclopedia of American politics and elections. The founder of Ballotpedia is here. Join in on your experience using Ballotpedia as a reference site, what you want to know about its work to stay neutral at this time of deep political distrust and partisanship, and providing voters with information about their ballots. 800-642-1234. Leslie Graves is founder and CEO of Ballotpedia. Leslie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So there are hundreds of thousands of local elections throughout the country. How do you keep all of your election records up to date? How do you do this?
That's a great question. It's a complex logistical chore, and we are not yet fully comprehensive of all local elections. So we cover the federal elections, obviously. Then we cover about 10,000 elections every 2 years that cover all of your statewide elected officials, state treasurer, governor, attorney general, and so forth. And then all of the state legislative candidates. And for years, we've also covered the largest of the elections in the largest school districts, the largest cities and so forth. But there are about 500,000 local elected officials throughout the United States, and that's county, town board, whatever. And we have a ways to go to get every single one of them covered. This year, we will end up covering of all of those 28%, and we believe we'll be at 100% or at 95% in 2024.
Wow. So a lot of this is data driven, obviously, but how do you then coordinate and vet the journalists to write all these articles that you produce?
So we invest a lot more elbow grease in writing our overview articles about elections, for example, the U.S. Senate election in Wisconsin this year. Mm-hmm. We invested a ton of effort in covering that Kansas abortion-related constitutional amendment yesterday. And in fact, when Ballotpedia started 15 years ago, we were only planning to write about statewide ballot measures. It was initial dream, just to write about those, because those are less well understood. They can be very complicated. Trying to figure out what the language means is a chore. We do put more elbow grease into those types of elections than into a town board election.
I wonder, through those 15 years, how you view Ballotpedia and your work through the model and lens of Wikipedia, that is, you know, this crowdsourced collaborative digital encyclopedia.
When we started, it was our intention to make sure that we eventually covered all of the down ballot races. Mm-hmm. And we were aware that the wonderful community of volunteers on Wikipedia wasn't doing that. So to this day, there are still a number of state legislators that there is no article for them on Wikipedia. So we wanted to make sure that got done. And then if you go further down, they don't have volunteers writing about those yet, but we wanted to make sure that they did get written about. But we had volunteers, the same kind of open platform for about 5 years. And what we found is that the volunteers would usually be people who were probably clearly working for a PR agency, not, you know, the wonderful community volunteers that are what you want. But we do have a community of volunteers now who help us get a ton of data.
Before we talk about neutrality, it's really interesting to me that you also survey candidates themselves to hear about their viewpoints and their political philosophies, and you get, you know, thousands of these questionnaires back. What do you want to know from these surveys, and what are you trying to do with them?
Sure, that's a great question. And by the way, for us and for anybody to comprehensively cover all of the elected, you know, the 500,000 elected lawmakers in the United States, they need to say something about who they are. And what we have found the further down you go on the ballot is that many of them don't even have a Facebook page. Hmm. So we realized a couple of years ago that it's our job not just to tell you if you're going to go vote next Tuesday, that these are all the people that are going to be on your ballot for all of the contests, but we or somebody else needs to be able to tell you a robust amount of information about those individuals so that you can choose who stacks up with your values. So the survey is something that we really started building about 4 years ago. because some of them offer no information about themselves online. So it's a way of giving them an opportunity to answer a lot of questions about themselves. We regard the questions that we ask as sort of a, here are some questions, pick the ones you wanna tell people who you really are, and they pick and choose. And we do not ask a lot of issue-oriented questions. We rely on the local media to really go after candidates and find out on the hot button issues where they stand.
Interesting that you don't allow redos of the surveys, I noticed. So candidates can't like change their mind about their answers. And I chuckle when I say that because politicians always seem to be changing and evolving over time. What is your thinking behind that?
We do have a method, and this happens sometimes, that a candidate will submit their survey during the primary season, and then they'll want to come back in maybe October and change some of their answers. And we do have a method that allows them to do that.
Oh, okay. Leslie Graves founded Ballotpedia, getting an inside look at this digital archive of U.S. political races. Join in on how you use Ballotpedia, what you want to know about their journalistic work, what it means for documenting American politics at this moment. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're inside the work of Ballotpedia, sponsored by the Lucy Burns Institute. It's a Middleton-based nonprofit, nonpartisan educational organization that changed its name to Ballotpedia in 2016. Since then, publishing hundreds of thousands of articles to inform people about politics at all levels of government with a mission for neutrality. Join in about this work, 800-642-1234. Leslie Graves, founder and CEO of Ballotpedia, stays with us. Leslie, let's talk about bias for a moment. And, you know, you have this firm mission to be neutral. Has that become more difficult in this age of misinformation and disinformation and distrust of mainstream media?
I would say that for us, a bigger challenge is the logistical challenge of just getting down ballot candidates to say something about who they are and doing that huge database. But we do have many rigorous processes that we've developed over the years to deliver non-biased information. And one of the most important ways that we try to do that is that there's a notion in linguistics called speech tribes. And it turns out that if you are left of center or if you are right of center, people who are right of center tend to, if they're talking about issues having to do with guns, will use language like Second Amendment rights, whereas people who are left of center will use language such as gun control. And you see that on all, most of the hot button political issues is that each of the speech tribes, as it were, use different language to refer to the topic under discussion. And so we really try hard to develop terminology that characterizes it without using speech tribe terminology. Because, for example, if you were to come on Ballotpedia but we had a bunch of paragraphs and they referred to Second Amendment rights, a reader would conclude, well, these people must be a bunch of right wingers writing this website, or vice versa. And so we spend a lot of time on that, and all of our staff engages in that conversation on an ongoing basis. And we do an enormous amount of bias training for new and old employees. And we also make it very easy for members of the public, if they are reading an article and they are looking at that and they think they're putting a thumb on the scale on this article in one way or another, whatever they think, for them to write in. We capture all those instances of reporting from the public, and we work through it and make sure that we fix whatever needs to be fixed.
Your organization last month analyzed wave elections in our country from 1918 to 2016. Explain what makes a wave election.
Sure. There is no standard academic definition, but we decided that we would define a wave election going back 100 years, that it is in the top 20% of flipping. Mm-hmm. So if 20%, if the number of seats that flip are in the top 20%, looking back over 100 years, we would call those results a wave election. And you can apply that to U.S. Senate, U.S. House, state legislatures, and so forth. It's a different number for each of them. People throw the word around loosely, and people will talk about the possibility that this November might be a wave election for Republicans. They actually would need to pick up 5 dozen U.S. House seats for it historically to be considered, by our definition, a wave election. But Wisconsin is super interesting in terms of that, because when you look at the U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin, it is considered to be one of the on the edge of a knife as to whether it would go Democratic or Republican this November. And there are other races like that in Wisconsin. And what will happen nationally, I grew up in Wisconsin. I live here. I love Wisconsin. It is one of 13 states that has a divided government in terms of the governor versus the state legislature.
Mm-hmm.
If unusual things happen that are anti the predicted red, quote unquote, wave, then all national eyes are going to be looking at Wisconsin and wondering what happened. Why did that happen? What's different about Wisconsin? What are the voters there thinking and doing? So we will increasingly get more attention on what the voters in Wisconsin are up to.
Talking about political data collecting with Leslie Graves, founder and CEO of the election encyclopedia Ballotpedia, you can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Leslie, that leads right into Wisconsin having the second most pivot counties of any state other than Iowa. Pivot counties, these counties that flipped from Obama to Trump in the 2016 election. What do you see happening in these counties as you look at your data?
Well, in 2016, there were 206 counties across the whole country where the county had voted for Obama twice, but then in 2016, they pivoted and voted for Donald Trump. So those are 206 interesting counties, right? And there are 23 of them out of Wisconsin's 72 counties were pivot counties. One county, which is my beloved Sauk County, I live right next door to it, is Sauk County, and that is a boomerang county. So then in 2020, it boomeranged back to the Democratic column. Now, a number of those pivot counties are along the Mississippi River, and that brings us to Wisconsin 3, the district that Ron Kind is the Democratic incumbent in,
mm-hmm.
and he is not running. And it's a very close race. There are 3 or 4 Democratic candidates running to get the party's nomination on Tuesday, but that'll be a fiercely contested fight for that open seat. And it's right in where a lot of those pivot counties are. So a lot of national eyes will also look on that to see whether the Republicans pick up what has been a Democratic seat for some time. Be very interesting.
I want to land here on school districts. Ballotpedia covers school board elections. I think your site says 470 school districts. What
yes.
are you seeing change in the elections in school board races in this election space?
Really quickly, we started covering all school board recalls 10 years ago. Just because I'm interested in recall elections. So we have a national database of how many school board recall elections have occurred across the country every year for the last 10 years. And last year we noticed there were many more than normal, than the historical average. So we also started, and that's because of these hot button issues that are arising in school boards that had not been so dominant. And we then saw that those hot button issues are also making waves in, normally contested school board elections. And yes, there are a historically high number of people running for school board. And those school board elections are also becoming races that national or statewide figures are weighing in on.
Endorsements.
In a way that they didn't. Yes. And for example, Rebecca Clayfish in the April school board elections in Wisconsin endorsed nearly 60 school board candidates, which is an atypical behavior for a gubernatorial candidate. Historically, I'm not saying it's atypical in a different way. And then just about a month ago, Ron DeSantis in Florida did the same thing. He popped up with a website saying, here are my 10 beliefs about what you should do or think if you are a school board candidate. Take a look, and if you agree, let me know, and I'll consider endorsing you for school board. So all of that is relatively new behavior, but I expect that we'll be seeing more of that in more states across the country.
Leslie, thank you for joining us.
You are welcome.
Leslie Graves is founder and CEO of the Wisconsin-based Ballotpedia, the digital archive of U.S. political races. Ahead this hour, we discuss plans to delay shutting down 3 coal-fired power plants and what that means for the transition away from fossil fuels. News update is next here on the Ideas Network.